All right, good afternoon. Everyone can have a seat. Calling case number 86847, Dayani. Am I saying that right?
You are.
Dayani versus District Court. All right, Mr. Gentile, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
You going to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5.
All right, excellent.
Maybe 10. I'll do 5 up.
Whatever's your pleasure.
Well, if I don't use the 10, I want it later.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. In this court, in the case of Mayo versus 8th Judicial District Court, and that's cited multiple times in everybody's pleadings, this court held that when a prosecutor has abused NRS 172.1452 by withholding known exculpatory evidence and engaging in conduct that impairs the function of an independent and informed grand jury, the courts of this state have not stood silently, and it cites State versus Babayan. Now, what's interesting is that Mayo came before this court by way of a writ. Babayan came before this court by way of a motion to dismiss. And that is what brings us here. Is there only one way, and does it matter? I have an opinion on that. Historically, courts, when they are reviewing insufficiency of the evidence, are bound by the evidence below. In this instance, the grand jury transcripts reveal that although it's a possession case, and although dominion and control and who had dominion and control are the only issues, and although those can be proven by mere presence, enough for the slighter marginal standard at least, when you're dealing with prosecutorial misconduct for failing to bring evidence before the grand jury, it isn't in the record below. Yesterday, we supplemented our authorities. Mr. Lally received a copy of it. I believe the court has received a copy of it. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, but it deals with exactly what I just said, but at the level of a preliminary hearing. The question is, why should it be any different in front of a grand jury? And this statute, 172.1452, it's really kind of sui generis to Nevada, because it grew out of the ABA grand jury model rules that happened back in the 70s. Nevada adopted it, and New York adopted it, and nobody else did. And I know that because I was on that committee with the ABA at that time. So, you know, we have a situation here where our legislature has deemed that in order to ensure that grand juries won't indict a ham sandwich, as we have all heard, won't become a mere rubber stamp for the prosecutor is bound that when he's aware of evidence, which was really the issue here, if he's aware of that evidence, and if it does explain away the charge, he must present it. And if he does not, I submit to you, it's structural error, because it destroys, as was said in Mayo, it destroys the independent and informed grand jury. And you have to proceed in a criminal prosecution one of two ways into that, by way of a complaint, which they started this one with. Somehow they had a change of plans. I'm not criticizing that today. When you're going to choose to go by way of a grand jury, especially since there's nobody there speaking for the target, then you have to abide by 172.1452. And in this instance, if anybody could look me in the eye and say that a third-party confession is not exculpatory in the highest degree, then I'd love that, because we could debate that.
Well, counsel, what do we do with the fact, well, strike that. If the court were to agree with you that it could have gone by either vehicle, and the court clearly here said, hey, it's untimely, it said it's untimely, but I find no prosecutorial misconduct to dismiss this case.
It's a due process violation. Okay. That's what it is. Prosecutorial misconduct can happen in bad faith, and it can happen just simply by improper proceeding. And this court has held that. The prosecutorial misconduct requires a two-step analysis. Number one, you have to decide if the prosecutor's conduct was improper. Clearly, the prosecutor's conduct was improper here. Okay, I don't think there's any question about that. That explained the way who done it. The second test at that point in time is whether the improper conduct warrants the remedy of dismissal of an indictment. And I submit to you that it does. The statute makes that clear. Babayan made that clear. Babayan is so close to what you have before you, and I think we have a stronger case.
Do you think that the judge reached the merits?
No.
Whether you agree with them or not.
No. I don't think he did, and I can cite to the record for that. Number one, in the answering brief at page 6.
But in his written order, he says, and I'll read to you from it, further, the court does not find prosecutorial misconduct occurred that would
warrant. That's an advisory opinion, and I'll tell you why. Number one, the state never challenged it. In its opposition to the motion to dismiss, it proceeded only with regard to the procedural objection that said that it had to be brought by a writ. And it actually asked for permission in that opposing brief that if the judge didn't agree with them, then they wanted an opportunity to go and brief the merits. So I doubt.
What should we do with this written order? On an extraordinary writ.
I think what you need to do is you need to read that language in context with what the judge said on the record at the end of the hearing. And he made it clear that he was ruling on a procedural issue. And, you know, my adversaries.
Oral remarks. I tend to agree with you orally on the record. That seems to me, you know, the transcript is not crystal clear, but that is what it seems like he's saying is I'm ruling on this as you're too late. It should have been a habeas.
And if you noticed, and I'm sure you did, Your Honor, I asked him, are you ruling procedurally? And that's when he responded the way that he did. So to the extent that other language, I could tell you that if you look at the minute order, the written order paired at the minute order, whoever prepared, it wasn't us, the order obviously parroted the minute order. So I think you need to read that as surplusage or as something in the nature of an advisory opinion. I don't know a good judge that would rule without at least hearing the other side. And the state was never weighed in on the question, which, by the way, in my opinion, violated Nevada rules of criminal practice 8-4B, and therefore they should be deemed to have forfeited that argument, and that gives you the power to dismiss it outright and tell them to start over.
What do you say, and I'm switching subjects a bit, but in the state's answering brief on page 10, they quote it several twice, they say that the prosecutor did present the exculpatory evidence to the grand jury, and they quote the prosecutor's statement. In addition to that, counsel for defendant has advised the state that he was told by defendant's aunt that Alina Jakshi, a female, told her that she is the true owner of the drugs, and it continues on.
That's not evidence.
Pardon me?
That's not evidence. That's nothing more than a statement by the prosecutor, okay?
Is that, appropriate statement?
No, not at all. I mean, first of all,
he goes on that he was later told that Alina Jakshi stated that she made up the story because she was offered a lot of money.
He was never told that, and I could take you to the record for that. I'm sure that you're aware of the multiple days of emails that were sent by me to the prosecutor in this case. At page 91, I say to the prosecutor, we have in our possession a thread of text messages in which a person we know only as Freddie is making an extortion threat upon Michelle Damani. All right. At page 93, I say, well, I mentioned that the guy choked a Rottweiler to death, and I say, so I'm notifying you and Chief District Attorney Palal about it. In his text, he claims to have information about a promise to pay Alina for taking the blame for the drugs and says that he has already notified a detective. However, he implies that he can call him off if the payment is made. A few moments ago, Alina herself called Michelle and reinforced the demand for payment by 2 p.m. At no time did she recant. At no time. There's nothing in what I wrote that could cause the inference that she recanted. So I don't know how. I have no idea where he got the basis for saying that. I never spoke to them other than by way in writing. And I'm glad it did. I take it that's my time.
It's still your time, but if you...
Well, I want to save it for rebuttal.
4 minutes and 33 seconds.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Lally.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Christopher Lally. I'm an assistant district attorney in for the County of Clark, State of Nevada. I'll be representing the State of Nevada at this argument. So good afternoon. The issue presented in this case is a very narrow one. Did the district court abuse its discretion in denying the motion to dismiss because it was not properly filed as a pretrial petition for writ of habeas corpus? In other words, was there an abuse of discretion here? So as this court said in State versus District Court concerning Armstrong, was the decision of the district court, quote, manifestly unreasonable or the result of partiality, prejudice, bias, or ill will? And I would submit to the court, it was not. There is a long list of authority that stands for the proposition that the failure of a prosecutor to present exculpatory evidence should be raised in a pretrial petition for writ of habeas corpus. In Sheriff versus Harrington, cited at 108 Nevada 896, a 1992 case, Harrington filed a pretrial petition for writ of habeas corpus based on a claim that the state had failed to present exculpatory evidence to the grand jury. In Sheriff versus Frank, 103 Nevada 160, a 1987 case, Frank filed a pretrial petition for writ of habeas corpus, claiming, among other things, that the indictment was invalid because the district attorney improperly withheld exculpatory evidence from the grand jury. In Moran versus Schwartz, cited at 108 Nevada 200.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but the cases, the issue has come to us two different ways. It's come up on petitions challenging orders on motions to dismiss, and then on either direct appeal or petitions with respect to habeas petitions in district court. So some of it seems to be the practitioners chose one path or the other, and then they brought it to us and nobody challenged it. So those statements are part of the recitation, but I don't know of a case where it's been contested and actually held that one should be pursued as opposed to the other, or that both are available, or where we are with
Justice
that.
Pickering, I agree with you. I agree with you. But the issue in the case is, did the district court here commit an abuse of discretion? That's the issue. Was there an abuse of discretion?
But why isn't it a legal determination as to the availability of a motion to dismiss?
Because in this case, the district court believed it was more akin to a challenge of the probable cause below. And so I'll just tell you, the defendant's motion to dismiss read like a pretrial petition for writ of habeas corpus, like the cases that I just cited to the court. It was argued that the state failed to present evidence which explained away the charge. That's a sufficiency of the evidence argument. In the motion to dismiss, Mr. Gentile argued, quote, I hope that there was fingerprinting and DNA taken from the packages of drugs and photos of both the master bedroom and bathroom with the drugs so as to help ascertain the identity of the individual who handled the seized narcotics. That's a sufficiency of the evidence argument, and that's at page 8 of the motion to dismiss, which is found in the record in the appendix at 14. Mr. Gentile also argued, it is also argued that the defendant did not have, quote, dominion and control of the controlled substances. That's a sufficiency of the evidence argument. That's not a prosecutorial misconduct argument. And that's found at pages 13 and 14 of the motion to dismiss in the record at 19 and 20. So just like the unpublished case of Williams versus State, which is cited at 135 Nevada 737, and 2019 case, which was cited below by Mr. Dickerson in his opposition of the motion to dismiss. At its core, what Mr. Gentile presented to the court was really a challenge of probable cause. This is exactly what Mr. Dickerson argued to the district court. This is not a motion to dismiss. This is a writ. And unfortunately for Mr. Gentile, he was well beyond the deadline to file that writ. Moreover, we know that the district court did not believe there was prosecutorial misconduct in the case. Quote, I understand you're arguing there's prosecutorial misconduct here, but to the degree there was anything done improper, I'm not sure it rises to the level where I would dismiss the case for prosecutorial misconduct. That's in the transcript of March 23rd, 2023 at the hearing in the appendix at 121. And
which 121 on the appendix?
It's in the appendix at 121. That was from the transcript. That was Judge Johnson. And Justice Pickering, as you have already pointed out, in Judge Johnson's order, he specifically says there was no prosecutorial misconduct. And that is in the record at 118.
What about the argument that that's advisory, that it was never teed up?
If you look at the transcript of that argument, Judge Johnson is well apprised of the merits of what Mr. Gentile was arguing. It was not an advisory ruling. And it's further apparent by the quote from Judge Johnson that I just read you. He reached the issue. He reached the merits, whether we argued it or not. He reached the merits of whether it was prosecutorial misconduct, and he found that it wasn't. Of course, the elephant in the room is that the exculpatory evidence was presented to the grand jury in this case. Chief Deputy District Attorney Michael Dickerson provided this admonishment to the grand jury. Counsel for the defendant has advised the state that he was told by defendant's aunt that Alina Jagshi, a female, told her that she is the true owner of the drugs. Counsel for the defendant also told the state that he was later told that Alina Jagshi stated that she made up the story because she was offered a lot of money. This is up to the grand jury to decide what, if any, weight to be given the information provided by defense counsel and whether or not you determine it to be exculpatory.
We have a statute, and I don't have the number at hand, but that says the state shall only present evidence to the grand jury, legal evidence.
Admissible evidence.
Right. So how is that statement, both the first sentence, but more concern to me, the second, about that she may have been falsifying this?
I will address that. What I'd like to do is explain to the court where that admonishment came from.
Okay.
It came from Mr. Gentile. It came from Mr. Gentile. This was the evidence Mr. Gentile provided to Mr. Palal in an email from June 27th, 2022 at 11:45 a.m.
What's the record site?
The record site is 97. Quote, I am, again, this is an email from Mr. Gentile to Mr. Palal. I am told she, Alina Jagshi, admitted to the drugs being hers. I am also aware that subsequently she told Flores that she did it. Flores is her boyfriend. She told Flores that she did it because she was offered a lot of money. So that will have to be addressed. That was Exhibit F to the defendant's motion to dismiss, which is found in the record at 97. So Mr. Dickerson's admonishment is virtually verbatim the information provided by Mr. Gentile and was provided to the grand jury, thereby satisfying the state's requirement to provide evidence to the grand jury, which will, quote, explain away the charge pursuant to NRS 172-145-2. There was no violation of the statute. There was no prosecutorial misconduct. What you're left with is, in the face of that evidence, is there sufficient evidence to indict, basically, to return the true bill? And basically, the time and the mechanism to file that is a pretrial writ of habeas corpus. And again, the time for that had passed. So going to your question, Justice Pickering, why not play the video? The video was not played because it was not in possession of the state. Mr. Dickerson and Mr. Palal did not have the video. All they knew was that Mr. Gentile believed there was exculpatory evidence on a body-worn video. Mr. Gentile did not have the video. What we know now is that the video was not in possession of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department because it was not, the statements were not made to a Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department officer. They were made to a city marshal, a separate law enforcement agency, a separate body cam filing mechanism, which we do not have access to. Even in his email of July 29th, 2022, again, this is in the record at 100, he does not identify, Mr. Gentile does not identify which city marshal interviewed Alina. He does not identify an event number where the video can be found. And the prosecutors, they did the best that they could with the exculpatory evidence that they had. They read it to the grand jury, almost verbatim what was provided to them by Mr. Gentile. There is no requirement in state law that they undertake the defense investigation of a case and go find evidence. There's more said by Mr. Gentile in his email to Mr. Palal. Same site at 100, quote, if you order forensics to both fingerprint and develop DNA from the bathroom and the contraband that was purportedly found in it, there will be none of Fod Dayani's. That's at 100. Is the state required because Mr. Gentile believes that maybe it will be exculpatory to bring forensics in and to process the evidence for fingerprints and DNA because he wants them to? Is there a requirement under state law that we do that? Of course there's not. If we are aware of exculpatory evidence, we're required to present it.
I want to circle back to the you're casting this as a sufficiency of the evidence challenge, and it looks like nationally, you know, not all states have a statute like we do. But those that do and that have considered it are usually expressed in terms of motions to dismiss without analytics on it. And it strikes me as a sufficiency of the evidence challenge would be that you didn't produce enough evidence to warrant issuance of an indictment. Your evidence is your evidence. They're wanting additional exculpatory evidence would contradict your evidence or undermine your evidence, but it wouldn't, if it were disbelieved, subtract from its sufficiency. So I have some analytical struggle casting this challenge to a breach of a statutory duty to provide exculpatory evidence as a sufficiency of the evidence challenge.
But we did present.
Follow what I'm.
Well, sort of. We did present the exculpatory evidence. We did.
No, I understand that. Let's leave that to one side.
Understood.
I'm trying to understand the analytical difference between a motion to dismiss and a petition for habeas in the context of allegedly exculpatory evidence that wasn't presented. The evidence was sufficient to warrant the issuance of an indictment, and had they called this woman or played the videotape of her confession to the city police officer, it wouldn't have subtracted, unless it were believed, it would not have affected the sufficiency of the evidence you presented. So my question is, how is that a sufficiency of the evidence challenge that needed to be presented on a habeas as opposed to via a motion to dismiss?
Yeah, so if the question, insofar as the question is, can a defense attorney challenge the failure to present exculpatory evidence by a motion to dismiss? In the abstract, my answer to you is yes, he or she can. What I am telling the court is Mr. Gentile's motion to dismiss was not a motion to dismiss. Based upon the content, the arguments that were made, when you're challenging dominion and control, when you're challenging whether the defendant himself actually possessed the controlled substance, those are not prosecutorial misconduct arguments. Those are sufficiency of the evidence arguments.
So may I ask one more question? So you would say that a motion to dismiss or a petition for habeas may be available in this setting depending on the exact argument that's made about the allegedly exculpatory evidence?
I would. I would agree that either is available. But again, the point is the way this motion was argued.
To be dressed up in
this was a, if it walks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And this was a duck.
Mr. Lawley, if I may.
Yes.
I hate to ask a question now when you end on a duck.
That was my grand finale, and you're going to ruin it for me, Justice. Thank you.
Are you of the opinion that the court reached the merits in any event?
I do think that the court reached the merits. And the court reached the merits by virtue of, and I know the court said, no, I'm deciding it on the procedural ground, but because of the black and white wording of the order, Judge Johnson found that there was no prosecutorial misconduct here. So I do believe, even though he said he was deciding it procedural, I do believe he reached the merits. And I don't know how you get around that based upon his order.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At their answering brief at page 6, I quote, they meaning Mr. Lally's client, district court based its denial on procedural grounds and stated that petitioner's motion, quote, could have been considered and should have been timely filed as a pretrial petition for writ of habeas corpus. It seems a little disingenuous to change that today. And again, I think if you read the transcript of the proceeding, he made it on procedural grounds. I move on. There was an argument in the United States Supreme Court once on a loudmouth lawyer from Nevada getting into trouble for talking to the media. And in that case, Justice Thurgood Marshall, it was his last day of hearing oral arguments on the court. He looked down at a man by the name of Robert Klonoff, who argued on behalf of the state of Nevada. And he said, Mr. Klonoff, do you really believe that a statement by a defense attorney is going to prejudice anyone? And that's what happened here. They put in a statement that they say I made. If they want to talk about what I said, put in the actual text of what I said. I did not say any of the things that he summarized in the way that he did. I never said, nor did I have any information that would indicate that Alina was recanting her statement. She was looking for money. She never said to Fetty
As far as I know, I don't know what she said to Fetty. I know what somebody told me Fetty said to them that Alina said to her, to him. Okay, but the bottom line to it is none of that indicated that she lied. And so they presented it in a way that gave a misimpression, just as the two bedrooms not being disclosed, the two bathrooms not being disclosed. And let's talk about what our statute requires and this word of exculpatory or favorable to the defense and how they don't match. Exculpatory evidence and evidence favorable to the defense is a Brady concept. That's when a prosecutor is supposed to turn it over to the other side. Our statute doesn't say you have to present favorable evidence or exculpatory evidence to the grand jury. It says you have to present evidence that explains away the charge. To explain away the charge, it has to go to an element of the charge. An element of every charge is who done it. That's where the Sodi, some other dude did it defense grew out of. And if the person who's being investigated isn't the one who done it, that explains away the charge. There is no stronger evidence that explains away the charge than what we had here on a videotape with an audio track from a woman who was admitting to it while in handcuffs in the back seat of a squad car.
So they're indicating that they didn't have access to that, and perhaps you didn't either, that it was a Marshal, it wasn't Metro.
I indicated it was Las Vegas jail. I indicated that. I'm not suggesting that each of you has to read all of the I'm getting a little heated up here.
I have a question though. Like, do you think that the statute obligates the state? And I'm not saying that this occurred in this case, but I'm testing. If this were perjured or false confession, do you think the state would be obligated to present it under that statute to the grand jury?
In a hypothetical, that would require at least some effort on the part of the state to investigate that. And if they felt that it was perjured or false, just like any other time that a lawyer is presenting evidence anywhere, they're not supposed to do it. But they didn't go that far. And I want to read something. This is cited in the appendix at 19. It's the case of State versus Autry. The district attorney, and this is quoting the United States Supreme Court case of Lovasco. The district attorney should, and I'm quoting, refuse to seek indictments until he is completely satisfied that he should prosecute and will be able to promptly establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. He had a lot of information here that should have had him at least at a minimum hesitate and do a little further investigation. And this is structural error.
Thank you, Mr. Brentill.